see if we can have a couple volunteers to pass these quizzes back. This isn't a quiz or anything, don't worry about it. We're talking about accent rules. And I want you to look at those forms, tell me if there's anything wrong, and what it is.
Apostol.
Okay?
What? It's got to be on the one last.
Right. Yeah. You can't have an accent out here. There's one syllable, two, three. You can only have an accent in one of the last three syllables. After a while, you get to the point where that sounds ridiculous anyway in Greek. I mean, you never hear the word apostolos, you know. The things sound normal as they've got, if they're on one of the last three syllables, but not there. So this is an impossible form. The accent can't go on the anti-P note, I guess what you call it. I don't know. Pre-anti-P note. I don't know. They don't have a term for it. Okay. What's wrong with this form? Or is there anything wrong?
The circumflex can't go on the third syllable.
Right. The circumflex can only go on one of the last two syllables. Here I've got it on the third to last syllable, the antipenal. So that's wrong. Okay. Anything wrong with that?
Yeah.
Right. Homophone is always short. You can't have a circumflex on a short syllable. Okay, that's a violation of rule number three. On your basic rules and your general rules of accent, the circumflex may stand only on a long syllable. That's rule three, part B. Okay. Let's look at these forms. Okay. Is there anything wrong with that? Len, go ahead,
sir.
Okay, that's a long.
It has something to do with the ultima being short.
Yeah, it has something to do with... You're getting warmer. Yes, over here? Yeah. Okay. The ultima is short. Now, what imposition does that place upon this? Yes. If it's going to have... If the penult is going to have the accent, when the ultima is short, if the penult has an accent, it's got to be... A circumflex if the penult is long, and an acute if it's short. This happens to be long, so we've got to, if we're going to have this accent, we have to have a circumflex. Okay? So that's rule number four, and just review it here real quickly. Rule four, if the ultima is short, part A, the anti-penult, if accented, may have only the acute accent, but now we're talking about the penult. B, the penult, if accented, must have the circumflex if it itself is long, but the acute if it itself is short. So this being short, the accent on this syllable is going to be dependent upon whether this is long or short. If it's long, you've got a circumflex. If it's short, you've got an acute. Okay? And the same would be true... Well, let's see. Let's just put the form down here. Okay. I've got the same error here, really, because omicron iota, when it's final, is considered short. So because that's considered short, this has to be a circumflex. If the accent falls on the syllable, by the same rule, but just note that this is considered short when it's final. Okay, what about this? Yeah, right off the bat, circumflex tangle on the third of the last oval. Also, if you're looking at the fourth rule there, you've got a short ultima, which means that if the antipenal is accent, it's got to have an acute. And it can't be circumflex. So that's really kind of a deduction from that first rule anyway. Okay, let's take a look at a few more examples just to get used to this. Now again, we're not able by these rules to determine exactly where the accent will go, but we can eliminate certain possibilities because they'll violate the rules. All right, here's another form. Okay, what's wrong with that? Or is there anything wrong? Right. Because the ultima happens to be long, the antipenal can't be accented. When the ultima is long, only one of the last two syllables is going to get an accent. And it's kind of, think of it kind of, you're getting some more weight on this end, and it's going to pull the accent down that way. Okay. And the same mistake would occur if I had omicron upsilon here. That would also be the same problem. So actually, the accent shifts. Now, in the word apostolos, the accent was on the syllable in the nominative form. But when you use the genitive or dative forms, the accent has to shift down to the next syllable, apostolou or apostolo. So this is why some of you may have noticed that accents on words have shifted in some of these forms, and this is the reason why. In the genitive and dative, you're getting long suffixes, whereas in the nominative and the accusative, you generally have short suffixes. And if the word was accented on the antipenal, then when you go to the genitive and the dative, you're going to get an accent shift because the accent can't be on the antipenal when the last syllable is long. Okay, there are some other forms though that you'll see. For example, apostela, which is the vocative form. We haven't really talked about vocative yet. We'll get to that later on. But this has got a short suffix, so that's perfectly all right. And even in the nominative plural, where you get the omicron iota, that's fine there too, because that's considered short. So as long as that's short, you can accent the antipenal. But if that becomes long, in the course of inflection, that becomes long, then the accent will have to shift. Okay? And by the same token, it forms like this. Okay. What's wrong with that? Remember.
Acute,
right. You only have the acute when this thing's long. So that's rule 5, let's see. 5B, yes. The penult, if accented, may only have the acute when the ultima is long. So again, you can't get a circumflex here. It's going to have to be acute. And the same would be true in the omega nu ending. See, this is long. That's going to have to be an acute. Okay. But see, you'll find that with dumos, see, the accent starts off. This is the nominative form, and it is a circumflex in the nominative form. That's okay because it's short. But when you go to the genitive or dative or genitive plural or something like this, where you get a long suffix here, then this circumflex changes to an acute. So if you look at a paradigm of something in the ornament, how come the circumflex changed to an acute there? It has to do with these rules. Now again, we don't know, there's no way that any of these rules are going to tell you that this was a circumflex in the nominative. You just have to learn that as part of the vocabulary. But knowing that was a circumflex in the nominative on that syllable, you can predict it on the basis of these rules, the changes that will occur, or at least what's necessary. You can at least predict that it would be in violation of the rules if you tried to continue to use that form. Okay? Any questions on these basic rules of accents? Now, for this next quiz coming up, and I think we'll make it on November the 1st, Tuesday, so we'll put that date down. It'll give us a little bit of time to review here and everything, and it won't be sneaking up on you that fast, but we'll be having a quiz, grammar quiz, on Tuesday, November 1st, which is a week from next Tuesday, so about a week and a half from now. And the quiz will cover chapters 7 through 11 in the textbook. chapter 7 through 11. And it'll also cover these accent rules that we've had so far, the basic accent rules. So it'll cover the accent rules on pages 317, 318, and 319 in the textbook. 317 to 319. It will not cover the rules on pages 320 and following, those more specialized rules. Only cover the rules we've covered thus far. Okay, so the quiz will be chapters 7 through 11, inclusive, and pages 317 to 319, inclusive, on the Greek accents. And we'll be spending a good portion of the time from now till then reviewing and going over this again and making sure that we've answered any questions that still arise. Okay, so with that in mind, let's go ahead and do some review. We'll come back to these accents by way of review, unless there's any other questions on these accent rules right now. Now, a little bit later on, we'll come back and do some of these special rules of accent. There's some special qualifications and so forth, and additional impositions that are placed upon nouns and verbs, but we'll get to those in due time. Yes, John?
You said today we would probably put the full paradigm.
Yeah, that's what we're going to do next. Yeah, we're going to put the paradigms on the board, and then we're going to go through and review. Okay? So if you want to use a separate sheet of paper here and take these paradigms, put these paradigms down and put them in a separate spot in your notebook, it'd probably be wise to do that. Or if you don't prefer to do that right now, you can do that, you know, later. Just get this information down. And this will be a complete paradigm for first and second declension nouns and also for the adjectives that we've had thus far that fall into these categories. So let's see. Get enough space on the board here. I think we'll start over this side.
Mike?
Mm-hmm.
Will we be working with
the vocabulary? On this quiz, yes, you'll be responsible for the vocabulary that you've had thus far, that first vocabulary quiz, because there'll be some translation, but the translation will be involving only those vocabulary words. And in some cases, I may stick a verb in there, but I'll tell you what that is. Like the exercise, I don't know anything about verbs yet. All right? So you will be responsible for the vocabulary in that first list that we've given you in order to do translation exercises. There's not that much, but there's a few sentences at the end so that you have to translate. And there's no way around it. You've got enough of vocabulary here to do anything with Greek. All right? Okay, let's look at the complete noun paradigm now. First of all, we'll take first declension. And set up our paradigm as standard singular, nominative, genitive, dative, accusative, and the plural, nominative, genitive, dative, accusative. And we'll include all of the variations across this way. Okay, first of all, we'll consider the feminine, and there are three categories of these, and then we'll consider the masculines over here. There's two categories of those. Now, the reason there's three categories of feminine has to do with the fact that the stem sometimes ends in a roller vowel, and with the fact that there's some of these other kinds. So we've got really three subcategories here. We've got the ones that the stem ends in a roll or vowel. And then, well, we'll put that paradigm here. This is alpha, alpha sigma, alpha with the iota subscript, alpha nu, and then the nominative plural alpha iota, omega nu, the genitive, alpha iota sigma, and alpha sigma. Okay. And then you're just your regular eta types. We'll put in the middle. You don't need any real designation. This is your most common type. Eta, eta sigma, eta with the iota subscript, eta nu, alpha with the iota subscript, alpha iota, excuse me, don't put subscript on that. Too sloppy here. Omega nu, alpha iota sigma, alpha sigma. Okay, and then you got your other kinds. I'll just put other here. Like delta or thalassa or one of the words of the double sigmas. This takes alpha in this column but eta sigma is in this column, eta with yoda subscript, then alpha nu, alpha yoda, omega nu, alpha yoda sigma, and alpha sigma. Okay, so there's your feminines. Maybe put a double line here, and we'll look at our masculines. The masculine first declensions are really of two types. We have first the stem ending, the normal type is just with the eta. We have eta sigma. We have omicron epsilon in the genitive singular. That's the most unusual feature, I suppose, of this. Eta with the yoda subscript, eta nu. And in the plurals, alpha yoda, omega nu, alpha yoda sigma, and alpha sigma. Okay, then if stem ends in a row or a vowel, just like the other ones, we will have alpha sigma here rather than eta sigma. Omicron epsilon stays the same. This becomes alpha with the yoda subscript, alpha nu, and the plurals are the same. Okay, that's your complete first declension paradigm. Now, let's just pay attention to a few features of it that might help simplify the memorization process. I'm always looking for ways to cut down the workload here. I guess natural human beings, I guess. Mm-hmm. And notice, for one thing, that your plurals in first declension are all the same, whether they're masculine or feminine, whether the stem ends in a row or vowel or one of these other kinds. Notice it's always alpha iotas, omega nus, alpha iota sigma, and alpha sigma. So you really only have four forms to memorize for the plurals. So that'll cover all of your first equation. There's no differences in the plurals. So that's the first thing to take note of. Okay, then you might take note, at least in the feminines, that the only difference between the ones that stem in the row or vowel is just that it's alpha here where it's eta here. But everything else, the sigma there, the nu there, the iota there, don't need to go that far. But the yoda subscript and the nu there, they're all the same. The pattern is identical, except you just swap the alpha for the eta. And then, if you think of these other kinds as kind of a cross between these two, then it might help. Because the other kinds are like these in the nominative and accusative, but they're like these in the genitive and dative. So that's just kind of a mix of these two. So there's really nothing new here. It's just a matter of arranging these forms. So that'll help you with the feminines. Now with the masculines, the major thing to keep in mind is this omicron epsilon, because this is looking like this is a second declension type of an ending that's stuck here on the genitive. Other than that, the major unusual feature is the presence of a sigma in the nominative. So the nominative and genitive are a little bit unusual, but the rest of the paradigm from there on is just like these over here. Either you're going to have the eta types like this, or the alpha types like this. And so, aside from nominative and genitive, everything is the same in the masculines as it is in the feminines. Same kinds of distinctions, anyway. So pay attention to your nominative and your genitive, especially for your masculine first declensions. And again, that will remember those and everything else will fall into place. Okay? So that's the complete paradigm. Now, we haven't really dealt with vocative forms yet, but as you'll see, most of the time the vocative form is the same as the nominative form. And evocative is relatively rarely used. Evocative is in the case where you're addressing someone, O King or something like this, you see. And we haven't even talked about it yet because it's not used that frequently. We'll just kind of tack that on a little bit later on, but it's no real need to put it in the paradigm even. Most of the paradigms in the textbooks don't have evocative. Okay, then let's go to the second declension. And we'll break this down the same way: singular, nominative, genitive, dative, accusative, plural, nominative, genitive, dative, accusative. Don't need too much space here to leave it. It might even help when you're setting this up to put a double line here between the singulars and plurals. A little bit clearer. Okay, now we really only have two major types here. We've got the masculine or feminine. Because masculine and feminine second declensions are identical. And then we have the neuters, which are a little bit different. Okay, and this will take care of our second declension. All right, in the masculine and feminines, the nominative singular is omicron sigma, then omicron upsilon for the genitive singular, omega with the otus subscript for the dative singular, omicron nu for the accusative singular, the plurals omicron iota, omega nu, standard, omicron iota sigma, and omicron upsilon sigma. Okay, so there's your second declension for masculines or feminines. So for masculines like feos, or for feminines like hodos, that's the paradigm. No differences between the masculine and feminine. The neuters are slightly different. For the nominative singular, we have omicron nu. The genitive is omicron upsilon. The dative is omega with the other subscript. The accusative is omicron nu. The plural nominative is alpha. Plural genitive is omega nu. Plural dative is omicron iota sigma, and the plural accusative is alpha. Okay, just a few things to observe about, this is the complete second declension paradigm. Just a few quick observations though that maybe help memorization again. Now that we have the genitive and dative forms, you can see why the neuters are called second declension, because they're just like these others. So as far as the singulars are concerned, the only difference that you're going to see in the neuter paradigm from the masculine or feminines is in the nominative. That'll be omicron nu. Whereas in the accusative it's the same, and the genitive datives are the same. So that's the only oddball place there. Then in the plurals, it's both nominative and accusative that have alpha instead of omicron iota and omicron upsilon sigma. But the genitives and the datives are the same. So as many of those patterns as you can observe, the easier it'll be to memorize. Okay, any questions? All right, now let's add on to this the article, because the paradigm of the article is important in terms of, it's got some slight peculiarities. We want to note those, so we'll put another paradigm down here for the article. This is what you want to know, because you're going to be using the article all the time. So, again, singular, nominative, genitive, dative, accusative, plural, nominative, genitive, dative, accusative. Of course, we're going to have three forms of the article, the masculine, feminine, and neuter. Remember, the article is a word that's inflected for gender, so we're going to have all three genders involved. Okay, and so we'll make it masculine, feminine, neuter. Okay, the masculine is ho, don't forget the breathing mark, rough breathing. And masculine genitive is to. Dative is to. The accusative is tone. Now I'm using acute accents on these in the paradigm, but realize that when you stick it on a word, it's going to change to a grave if the word's accented. It almost always will be the noun. Okay. Hoi for the plural. Tone. Omega nu with circumflex. For the genitive. Tois. For the dative. Also with circumflex. And toots. Acute. For the accusative. Feminine. He. Tate. Genitive, K, iota, subscript on the eta, for the dative, and tane, for the accusative, high, tone, tight, and tox. Neuter, toe, nominative, two, genitive, toe, omega with the other subscript, toe with the omicron again for the accusative, ta, oops, sort of like toys and top. Okay, a few observations on this. All of the articles begin with a tau, except for masculine and feminine nominative singular, masculine and feminine nominative plural. In other words, only in the nominative are you going to find no tau there on any of the articles. But the neuters will have tau all across. Neuters have tau in all of them. But the masculines and feminines in the nominatives will not have the tau. Okay, so that's just one way to remember where the tau's go and where they don't. They're everywhere except for the nominative and the nominative in the masculines and feminines, most singular plural. And if accent, again, this isn't required, but it might be a good idea, but since the article's used so frequently, just to observe what the accent pattern is. Your nominative forms, masculine and feminine, are in clitics. There's no accent on them. Notice you just got a breathing mark. And that's the same with the plurals. So those are both, those four forms are in clitics. There's no accent on them. Other than that, what kind of general pattern can you observe about the use of the accents on this? Just inspecting the pair deck.
All genitives have circumflex and all datives have, all accusatives have acute.
Acute, okay. Yeah, genitives and your datives, really. Genitives and datives, you see. There's circumflex there in those forms all across the board and circumflex in all of these forms. But your accusatives are having only the acute. And then your nominative in nominatives and accusatives in the neuters are going to have acutes also. So that's the basic pattern. Genitive and dative have circumflex. You just remember that. And everything else has got an acute except for those enclitic forms in the nominatives that don't have any accent. It's pretty easy to remember. Yes?
Now, on the part of what a circumflex is that remain a circumflex?
Yes, on the article it'll remain a circumflex because you're not getting any other syllables added or any kind of shift there. So, yeah, that'll be fine. Now, this holds only for the article. If you're dealing with nouns, so some of the things may happen, but...
Not shifting, but changing to a grave or anything.
Oh, no, it won't change to a grave or anything, no. The acute will change to a grave if the word following is accented. But since these are all monosyllabic, only one syllable, right. They're obviously the ultima. And they're also the ultima is the only syllable you got. So the acutes will change to a grave whenever they're actually on a noun. But the circumflexes won't change to anything. They just stay the same all throughout their usage. Okay? Now, the only thing we need to add to this is the adjectives, and we don't really need to write a paradigm down. We just need to write a couple of statements, because that'll take care of it. For the adjectives, let's see here. I don't want to erase anything. I'll try to squeeze it in here someplace. Hopefully, more room on your paper. The adjectives, all you need to say about the adjectives is that the masculine forms of the adjective are second declension. The feminine forms are first declension. And again, it's alpha type, it's stem, ends in roll or vowel. And eta type, otherwise. And there's no other kinds in the adjectives, like there was in the nouns, so you don't have to worry about that. So the feminines are first declension, alpha type of stem ends in row or vowel, so it's like mikra, or one of those, you see, it's going to have the same thing happen to it as the nouns do. And then it'll be eta type otherwise. By alpha type, I mean that your adjectives are going to take this type of an ending throughout the paradigm, just like that first declension feminine noun, if the stem ends in row or vowel, and it's going to take the eta type here otherwise. And you won't have to worry about these other kinds as far as adjectives are concerned. They don't have that. You'll get eight. Okay. And then the neuters are second declension. Wait a minute, I need to say one more thing here. Before we write neuter second declension, we can write second declension sometimes with adjectives like ionios. There's not very many of those, and we'll be noting those as we go. But remember, ionios has second declension endings for the feminine as well. That's why, remember, in your paradigm, you saw no separate feminine forms, because the feminines and the masculines are the same. So just add that one note. First declension for the feminines, it's first declension, and then second declension with a few like ionios. Okay, that'll complete the thing. Then the neuters are second declension. Okay, so we've got three forms of the adjective, masculine, feminine, and neuter, because remember, the adjective is going to agree with us now in case, number, and gender. Therefore, it's going to have different forms to indicate the gender, and those are done this way. Second clench for the masculine, first clench for the feminines, except for a few like ionials, and second clench for the neuters. So that's really all you need to know. If you know that information and know these paradigms, then you know what to do with all the adjectives that we've had so far. Now, there will be third declension adjectives, but we'll get into those later on and treat them separately. Okay, that's it. That's the full paradigm. With the information you have on the blackboard here, you can handle any first or second declension nouns or adjectives that you run into. So there'll be nothing new to add to this. The only thing that will be new to add is another declension, instead of third declension. And we're saving that until after we've had some experience with verbs and things. Okay, questions? So I would recommend copying this down, putting it in a certain section in your notebook and using it, and by all means, memorize it, learn it. That's the bottom line. For the test on chapter 7 to 11, you'll need to know this paradigm, because you'll be responsible for making all of these forms on the vocabulary words that we've had. Okay? Anything else somebody wants to ask? Oh, sure. If we had a screen, I could have put it on there. Okay, let's go back to chapter 7 then and do some review. And again, if there are any questions as we go on this review, this is the time to ask them so that you get have it clear in your mind as to what's happening and don't have any gaps in your understanding. Let's see. A few more of you came in here. I have test papers here. Steve Hamill, Steve.
Yes,
Jim. Okay, subject and object was our subject of chapter 7, and again, basically, he sets out a number of paradigms. There are a number of basic sentence types in English, about 11 of them here, and we'll be dealing with some more of the other types here. We've dealt with the first few of these in the course of this chapter 7 to 11, but we're going to be dealing with many of the other examples he's dealt with here a little bit later on in the ensuing chapters. The basic point of chapter 7 is the fact that your basic sentence type, subject, verb, object, in English is determined by word order. Subject and object are designated by word order. In Greek, they're designated by the use of the nominative case and the accusative case. So, there's a basic difference between Greek and English in terms of how one assigns the function of a word in a sentence. What rule, what grammatical device is involved in the assigning of a nominative, subject and object, that type of thing in a sentence? Remember from our government and concord distinction, which would be involved there?
Government.
Government's the thing that's determining what the function is in the sentence. Now, concord would be involving which adjectives went with which noun and that type of thing. Okay, So we're dealing with a grammatical device called government, and in Greek and in English, there are different specific rules that assign those things. In English, word order is your main factor. In Greek, it's case endings. Okay, so the point of section 45 to 47 is just to illustrate that difference between English and Greek in that respect. So in section 48, we see in italics here the basic rule, or basic observation. The subject of a sentence in Greek is normally indicated by a noun or pronoun in the nominative case. Conversely, the principal function of the nominative case is to indicate the subject of a sentence. Okay, then in section 49, we deal with the concept of a direct object. And the direct object of that is that which receives the action, is the normal definition of that. And in Greek, again, that is indicated by the accusative case, and not by word order like it is in English. And so he gives in italics here at the end of section 49 the basic rule there. The direct object in a sentence in Greek is normally indicated by a noun or pronoun in the accusative case. Now he says normally because there will be some exceptions to this. There will be certain types of verbs that we'll run into later on that will take genitive case for their objects, or even dative. So that'll happen once in a while, but that's usually because of a particular verb and the particular kind of meaning associated with the verb that lends itself to that kind of thing. And when we get to those, you'll see that there is a certain kind of logic behind it. Conversely, but by and large, it's the accusative case that we're dealing with. Conversely, one of the principal functions of the accusative case is to indicate the direct object in a sentence. And he says one of the principal functions, because there will be other functions of the accusative case that we'll look at later on. But all of them have a certain common idea in view. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, yes, that's probably not really an exception, though. But yes, it's true that very often you won't even have to state as a separate word the subject because it'll be contained in the verb form. So that's one reason why you may not see something in the nominative. There's other things get involved, too. Later on, when we get to infinitives and things like this, you'll find that the subject of an infinitive is in the accusative case. And these are complicating factors that deal with lots of other grammatical devices involved. And there are some nominatives that may not be the subject of a sentence sometimes. There are nominative absolutes and interesting grammatical features that get involved that complicate a little bit. But most of those are easily understandable within their own domain. You know, it's not really a gigantic exception to this. He's just trying to qualify it a little bit by letting you know that there may be some other complications, and there are. Yeah. So, in other words, very often you'll see a sentence that has nothing in the nominative case in it at all. There's no subject stated. It's a pronounal subject, and usually that is contained in the verb endings. So they don't need to write a separate pronoun. If they do go ahead and write a separate pronoun, there's usually a tremendous emphasis. Like ego e me, for example. To write ego e me rather than just a me, all you need to say is to say I am is a me. Because that contains the first person singular idea as well as the verbal idea. But if you say ego e me, and use the pronoun ego in addition to it, you've got a lot of emphasis. And that's why that phrase stands out very vividly in Greek, a lot more so than it does in English. Okay, yes. Well, that's a real hard question to answer, you know, if you haven't been in that position. And even if you talk to one, it's hard to know, you know, just if you're getting the ideas transmitted properly. Well, no, I don't know if I've ever really specifically asked them that question, but I think what happens is after you've had some exposure to Greek and you start thinking in Greek, then you start being able to relate to what it's like. And all I can do is tell you from my own experience in starting to think in the Greek patterns that you're picking up information from say a verb form that's got a certain conjugated form that's indicating the person and number and so forth. that information is coming right out of that without ever having to think so much in terms directly of I, he, she, it, you, or whatever. You see those pronoun ideas. They're there, all right. But you see, anytime as soon as you think about it in English, then you've got to have that pronoun there. But if you're just staying in the Greek structure, the information is there. You've got the meaning. You've got the understanding. You know what's going on. But you're not necessarily thinking. See, the Greek who's never been exposed to English isn't necessarily going to be worried or concerned about a verb to be being understood in a predicate construction. All he knows is that he's got a predicate construction, and this means such and such. And then if he goes on to learn English, then he'll have to learn that in English we have to supply a verb to be when we do that. We can't just stick things together. But that would be new to him, just like it's new to us not to have the verb in there, you see. So, in other words, he's just getting meaning without... see, it's very difficult for us to even talk about meaning until we put it in English words. And it takes a while of exposure to language to be able to just stay within the language and get all kinds of meaning transmitted without ever putting in English. And even after you're in that position, it's a lot easier for you to put it in English. Especially if you ever want to talk about it to somebody else, you almost have to. But there is a... Hebrew is the same. You know, when we get into the use of the participle, I think you'll begin to, in Greek, you'll begin to start sensing this more. That's probably more indicative of the way Greek does things than maybe a lot of other things. And you'll see the use of the participle, the way they'll do so much with one particular type of word that we wouldn't do, that getting to see those kinds of patterns begins to, after a while, you see you're getting meaning from that. You're not even consciously trying to put it over into English. You're getting it right from the Greek. And it's really hard to say what it would be like or what you're thinking, because as soon as you do that, you have to say, am I thinking in Greek or am I thinking in English? You know, if you're thinking in Greek, then you can't tell anybody, you know, that's speaking English and doesn't know Greek what you're thinking. You see, it's difficult. That's why these understanding the grammatical rules is really the key to this. If we understand how the rules work and how they fit together and what kind of meanings they transmit, that's what's really giving us this more than anything else. Now, to a native speaker, it's the habit patterns that he's picked up. See, he's not even conscious of the rules. That's just the way things are done. Just like we're not fully aware and conscious of all the rules that we have in English. I mean, when you say a sentence, you're not consciously stopping and thinking, now, what's the subject of this sentence? What's the verb? What's the object? And so forth. And, you know, you've said a lot of things that you probably couldn't diagram. And so that's the same as true in Greek. They're not consciously thinking of all of these different things. I'm sure they're not even consciously thinking of the declensions and all of the rest, you see. They just know what form, if you want to say it this way, that's the form you've got to have. Okay. It would be interesting to see what kinds of mistakes little Greek children make as they begin to learn, you see. And what are the hardest things for them to pick up and so forth. I've never asked them about that, but it'd be very interesting. Okay. Any other questions on this concept? Now, about the only other thing that's left in this chapter is just a matter of comparing the Greek and the English word order situation. Section 50 is comparing the English translations with the Greek. And notice that in English, we've got subject, verb, object in all these examples, in that order. Whereas in the Greek, it's subject, verb, object, subject, object, verb, subject, verb, subject, object. In other words, all the various permutations, all the various combinations of order. So the Greek isn't concerned about the word order here. It's only concerned about the case functions, with the exception of the position of the article. That's something it is determined by word order. And then later on, when we talk about adjectives, we find that adjectives also are governed by word order to a certain extent. The relative positions, the attributive and the predicate positions are very definitely dependent on word order. So Greek is not totally independent of word order. It's just that it doesn't use word order in a lot of places where English does. Do we have any basic questions on anything in this chapter? There's a discussion here, too, I suppose we should mention, about the idea of a transitive verb. You see at the bottom, page 40 here, and there's a footnote down there to explain it more fully. But basically, a transitive verb is one that has passive forms, but has both active and passive forms. Or another way to say it is that a transitive verb is one that can take a direct object. If it can take a direct object, then you can get a passive transform of it. And so we will spend more time on that concept later on. But when we get to Greek passive verbs and get into the concept of the voice, the active, middle, and passive, and we will be doing plenty with that, I'll guarantee you. We'll be seeing some things that in Greek English doesn't really have. Okay. But transitive verbs are ones that can take object and take direct objects and have both active and passive forms. And the rest of it is just describing describing in more detail the difference between Greek and English and the terminology that's being used. Any questions on it? Basic idea though: nominative case for the subject, accusative case for the direct object. In word order in Greek can vary. Okay. Chapter 8 is dealing with other sentence types. First type he deals with is the case in which you have a subject, verb, and an adverb. And the judge coughed apologetically, example that he gives. And basically he's saying that Greek is going to do basically the same thing as English in this respect, except for word order is not the critical factor. And there's nothing a whole lot to add about that. It's pretty much the same. But Section 54 gives some Greek examples of this and so forth, so I guess there's a little bit more in there. Subject, verb, adverb, and again, in Greek, it's just the subject is the noun and the nominative. You'll have a verb, then you'll have an adverb, and the adverbs don't decline. You won't have a case ending on an adverb in Greek. The adverb is an indeclinable word, so it's going to have the same forms. And but again, the word order will be variable in Greek. Then we get to section 55, 56. 55 introduces the predicate construction. His wife is a vegetarian. In this case, in English, again, we have noun one, verb noun two, but in this case, it's not subject, verb, object. It is subject, verb, and predicate nominative. And so we have a little bit different kind of construction. And that, of course, in Greek, turns out to be quite a bit different as well. In Greek, instead of having noun in the nominative, a verb, and a noun in the accusative, now we have two nouns in the nominative case with a verb. And sometimes in the Greek, of course, you don't even need the verb. And so we have what we call a predicate nominative construction. And it's a more special case of this simple sentence form. And he talks about equative verbs in English in section 56. And the two most important equative verbs in English are the verbs to be and to become. And the same is true in Greek. The verbs meaning to be, eimi, and to become, ginomai, are the two most common verbs that fall into this category. And they're the verbs that you're going to see in structures like this, where a verb is actually seen. Okay, and equative verbs are very unique types of verbs. They're a small class of verbs, and it's hard to define them in a real simple way, but the term equative is indicating that you're equating things. You're making one thing equal with another thing. You're identifying things or equating things together. And this is also true in Greek. Now, he goes on to talk about this in more generalized types of definitions that he's used to. And in English, I'm reading from the bottom of page 44. In English, we have to know whether a verb is equative or not, generally speaking. If we encounter a verb previously unknown to us, we will not be inclined to regard it as possibly equative, for the class of equative verbs is far too restricted. If we should come across a sentence like, his wife Milver, a vegetarian, for example, we would be more likely to understand Milver to indicate some action performed by the wife and received by the vegetarian, rather than the wife is characterized in some way, on some unfamiliar way, as a vegetarian. So it's not real precise exactly how we assign this equative verb category, but basically the equative verb is somehow characterizing something rather than indicating an action. To be isn't an action, it's a characterization of a state of being, something of that nature. Okay, section 57 then talks about the Greek construction that parallels the English predicate nominative construction. And in Greek we see some significant differences. In Greek, again, we are going to see, rather than word order being used, we're seeing case function being used to assign the structure. And in this case, we're going to see two nouns in the nominative case. That's what's going to indicate a predicate nominative construction. Both of the nouns will be in the nominative case. And you'll see an equative verb also. But actually, we don't really get into it much in this passage because he's not really dealing with the adjectives yet. But in the next chapter, when we deal with the adjectives and the positions of the adjectives, we will find out that most often you don't even need the verb to be. You don't even need a form of the equative verb in Greek to set up a predicate construction like this. They just have a predicate position for an adjective, for example, and that will do it. And with nouns, normally you will see a verb to be. So I guess a predicate nominative when you're dealing with a noun will be that way. But even so, an adjective can sometimes function something like a noun, and you can get a very similar kind of construction. So in Greek, then, our basic pattern is noun in the nominative, verb, equative verb, and noun in the nominative. But that introduces us to a problem. And the problem is, may not be a gigantic one, but the problem is, how do you decide which is the subject in a sentence like that and which is the predicate nominative, since they're both in the nominative case? So you've got two things in the sentence, they're both in the nominative case, and word order is not the thing that you're deciding it by. It's not word order. Then how do you, are you going to know which one's the subject and which one's the predicate nominative? How will you know whether to translate it A is B or B is A? And that is the subject of section 58. And there are five guidelines for making that decision. And you should be aware of these five guidelines for the quiz. Be aware of the, you don't need to memorize the examples or anything, but just know the basic concept. Five guidelines are, first of all, if one of them is a proper name. You don't have to be in this order necessarily either, but you should be aware of these five major guidelines. If one's a proper name, then that will be the predicate nominative. I mean, excuse me, that will be the subject, and the other noun will be the predicate nominative. The basic philosophy is the more definite of the two is the subject, and the least definite of the two is the predicate nominative. Because it's more likely, you see, when you're making a predicate nominative statement, to be talking about something specific and relating it to something more general, and describing it as being characterized by some other attribute or something that's common to other things as well. And so with that in mind, that's the way that the general guidelines run. So number one, if one's a proper name, that's going to be the subject. Secondly, if one of them has the article, if only one of the nouns has the article, in other words, one has the article, the other one doesn't, that is going to be your subject. And we'll see that one. You see that one in John 1, and the Word was God. The word "word" there has the article, and the word "God" doesn't. And so it's the Word was God. It's not God was the Word. It's not identifying God. It's really identifying the Word. Okay. Then thirdly, the one that has the narrower reference. Now that one gets a little bit more subjective, and as we've seen, some of the examples here may be debatable. But the one that has the narrower reference, again, the philosophy being that the subject of something is going to be more specific, and you're going to be relating it to a general, more general class. So the one that has a narrower reference will be the subject. That is, remember too that this isn't, in the example he's given you, hei hamartia estin hei anomia, I mentioned that I'd be inclined to reverse this. I would say lawlessness is sin rather than sin is lawlessness. Simply because sin, hamartia, missing the mark, there's lots of ways to miss the mark, and lawlessness is one of them. But another person could come along and say, well, all sin is transgression of the law, and he may take that as being the more specific thing, and the other the more general. It gets a little bit debatable, but remember, too, that we are dealing with an equative type of structure where things are being equated. And if there's a little bit difference of opinion as to which comes first, you're still drawing an equation anyway, so it's not as critical as it might sound. Then the fourth one is if something is referred to in the immediate context, it will be the subject. Again, because something that's referred to in the immediate context has been the topic of discussion, and so it's likely then if something's already been mentioned, that now you're adding more information to that thing you've already been talking about, and so that would be considered the subject. And then fifthly, if it's a pronoun, it will be the subject. And the pronoun is always going to be more definite. Now, it sounds a little bit ambiguous in a sense because you generally think of a pronoun as less definite because it doesn't have the actual name. But realize that within a context, a pronoun is very definite. The reason it's definite is because the fact that you can use a pronoun indicates that the context makes it clear who you're talking about. So that kind of relates to the previous rule. If something's referred to in the immediate context, it's going to be the subject. And if you can use a pronoun, the only reason you can use a pronoun is because something has been defined in the context, and you can relate to it. So the pronoun is going to be the narrower reference. Now, in this case, the pronoun may not always be expressed. It may be contained in the verb form. So sometimes you may only see one thing in the nominative, and the other thing is in the verb form. But we'll worry about that some more later on when we get to the refinements on that. Okay, that's the last of the time for today, but we'll continue review. You might want to just take a look ahead here and make sure that there's nothing that you're misunderstanding. And we'll review again tomorrow. I don't know if we'll finish all the review tomorrow. It depends on how things go. And then we'll forge on into the verb forms. Oh, Dale, there you are.